Welcome to Midpoint. I'm Sean Canaan, the host of Midpoint Monday. Today, we're going to talk about how BP's use of dispersants during the Deepwater Horizon disaster affected the health of cleanup workers. And if you have thoughts about that, I'd like to hear them. You can join now by calling 813-239-9663. Go ahead and get in the queue right now, 813-239-9663. If you like, you can email dj@wmnf.org. You can text us at 813-433-0885. My guest will be Craig Pittman from the Tampa Bay Times. First, I want to briefly go to a comment that was left by a listener after our last show. We looked at local grassroots solidarity efforts to collect relief supplies for victims of Hurricane Irma. We also talked about extended power outages. Here is one listener comment.
Lucas from Louisville, comment about your midpoint show on Monday afternoon. There was a comment made about the power outages where the utility companies at first said, essentially, don't call us. We know where the big outages are. And then some point later, some individuals had to call and report outages to get them fixed. And the commentator said it looks like they turned out to be wrong. And just wanted to clarify that a little bit. So when there's large power outages, the power companies monitor their equipment, and they're aware of large outages and, you know, broken transformers and problems at substations, and they're going to allocate their resources to fixing things that will restore the largest amount of customers first. And after those large problems are fixed and most customers are online, there are going to be smaller pockets of customers and individuals that are out that the power company is not aware of. So it's not that they were wrong up front. It's just they had a different goal in the beginning than at the end. So that's why those power companies give those dates that say we should expect to have people online by X date. And as the anecdote in the radio show said, you know, they had a person whose power was still off after that date. They called the power company, notified them, and then they came out and serviced that individual person. So just that clarification, if that helps at all. In the beginning, the power company is aware of large outages. They're working very hard, and they're going to do the things that restore the most amount of people the quickest. Thanks for your time.
Well, that was one listener commenting about our last show later on in the broadcast. I'll give out the number for you to leave a voicemail. You can always listen to previous shows and comment on the stories on our website. You can join in the conversation on Twitter or Facebook at WMNF News. Well, in April of 2010, an explosion rocked BP's Deepwater Horizon oil rig, killing 11 people and setting off an environmental disaster. Over the next 3 months, about 4.9 million barrels of oil gushed into the Gulf of Mexico. BP used dispersants on the ocean floor and on the surface to try to break up the oil. The first scientific study has just been published connecting human health problems with the dispersant use. Our guest today on the phone is Tampa Bay Times staff writer Craig Pittman. Welcome back to WMNF's Midpoint, Craig.
Thanks.
Thanks so much for joining me. Well, tell us about, you've written about this health study. It was by the National Institutes of Health. What can you tell our listeners about the health effects on humans from this dispersant?
Sure. Well, the National Institutes of Health started this study in 2011, where they're looking at the effects that the oil spill had on the people who were hired to do the cleanup. They figured those are the folks who came in direct contact with the oil. And so those are the ones who are most likely to show any sort of physical impairment or symptoms. And so they signed up about 33,000 of these folks for this study. And what they found initially was that they were at a higher risk for being impacted by the oil itself. And then this most recent study that they just published about a week ago showed that about 600 of them who came in direct contact out on the water with the oil and with the dispersants were impacted by the dispersants. Some of them showed skin rashes or skin irritations, eye irritations, trouble breathing, that kind of thing, when they were in contact with the dispersants. And then it cleared up afterwards. Some of them, however, the symptoms have not cleared up, and some, their symptoms did not begin until after the cleanup was over. And so they're still trying to look into what sort of long-term impacts there might be. But right now, what they've been able to show is that, yes, there were some short-term health impacts from coming in contact with the dispersants, which is the first time any sort of a federal study has been able to show that. There have been studies on the toxicity for marine animals, but when the EPA approved BP spraying this stuff directly at the wellhead and then over on the on the surface of the water in quantities that had never been used before. Nobody knew what the impact on human health would be. Now we know.
And it was at quantities on the surface of the ocean that had never been done before. But that type of dispersant use had happened before in other oil spills. When there's a slick of oil on the surface, they spray dispersants on it. And the idea of the dispersants is to break up the oil into smaller bits so that it eventually can be broken down by microorganisms. But this was the very first time, the only time at this point, that when dispersants had been injected into the wellhead, I might be saying it wrong, but down at the bottom of the ocean, right? This is the that was the yes. first time
they
it was used.
Yeah, they were spraying it directly at where the oil was spewing out, 5,000 feet below the surface of the Gulf. And that resulted in, it breaks up the oil, but if the oil doesn't go away, the idea is you break it up, and that way it's easier for microbes to consume it. But there was so much of it, and there's such a huge quantity of oil coming out, that that's why we saw the USF, for instance, the USF Marine Sciences folks, discovered this sort of ghostly plume of broken-up oil floating through the DeSoto Canyon down there, which is a very important area for spawning and breeding of very commercially important marine animals and so forth. And so I read once that they make the choice. You make the choice. If you're going to try to spare the ocean, then you try and contain the oil spill. If you're going to try and spare the coastline, then you spray the dispersant on it. And that's what they chose. They chose to try to spare the coastline, but ultimately it's bad for the Gulf of Mexico that they did what they did. But, yeah, that's a common practice. It's kind of ironic. The approaches to drilling oil have changed dramatically because of new technology over the last 20, 30 years, but the approaches to cleaning up an oil spill have not changed much at all since the 1968 Santa Barbara spill off the coast of California. And it's always the same stuff, spray the dispersants at it, try to burn some of it, try and use booms to collect it, and that's about it. And so there really has not been any sort of technological advances or even attempts at technological advances for cleaning up oil spills. In fact, USF St. Pete folks told me that they went to an oil conference recently where they were asking people there, and of course USF St. Pete has documented the impacts of the oil on Gulf specimens, and asked them, have you come up with any new techniques? And they said, no, we think that worked really well, so we're going to continue using those same techniques that we used during the BP oil spill.
So even though, I mean, this was before this study came out, but even though there was documented effects on marine animals, and now we're seeing these effects on human health, that they still apparently seem to think that this was the right decision.
Right. And now that the study has come out, there may be some change. We'll see. It's possible now that they'll say, well, if we do this, A, it's bad for the environment, but B, it could open us up to some sort of liability claim by the cleanup workers. So that might be a way that they might decide, maybe it's not worth it. Maybe now we need to come up with some different approach to trying to clean up oil spills.
Well, I have some more questions for you, but why don't we go to the phones right now and take some questions from listeners? Sound all right?
Okay.
All right. All right, well, we'll get Craig back right now on the phone. Sorry about that. Chris in St. Petersburg, why don't you ask your question? I accidentally dropped Craig off the line, but he'll be back with us in just a minute. So why don't you ask your question?
Well, what do you think of natural, safe, green, clean alternative to the dispersants of a highly alkaline ionized water that can emulsify oils if it's made at around 11 or more pH? And I called the Forestry Service during the time of the cleanup for the Gulf Gusher, and was told by the Forestry Service, United States Forest Service, and Fish and Wildlife Service that I personally could not go out.
All right, we just dropped Chris. Unfortunately, that was an accident as well, but I believe the good news is we have Craig back again. Is that right, Craig?
I'm back. Yeah.
All right, hopefully we won't drop you off again. Sorry about that.
Chris, did I miss the question?
Yeah, you did, but I can try to reproduce it as best I can. Chris is saying that has there been any kind of alternative alternative to dispersants, which is, for example, he was suggesting highly alkaline water. What would that do to break up the oil, and would that be an alternative?
I have not heard anyone suggest that. I think they'd need to do some testing first to see what sort of impact it would have. The EPA approved using these dispersants for the BP oil spill is there had been some toxicity tests initially that they thought showed that there would be no serious long-term impact to marine life, and so they okayed going ahead with it. I'm not aware of any sort of testing like that has been done for that particular suggestion, so they need to do that first.
Okay, we have Chris back. I'm going to go to him, and hopefully he can follow up with you, and if we do this right. Here's Chris, and Chris, did you hear what Craig's response was, and what did I get your question right?
I'm sorry, I'm listening. I didn't get it. I'm just listening to the live stream online that has a delay that's just getting to the end of my call right now. But I just wanted to, I'll catch his response, but I wanted to add that I think that the oil companies, and if not them, then the government ought to be responsible for putting out barges to take seawater and purify it to whatever degree necessary before ionizing it. And then they could have a natural way to disperse the water that's non-toxic. If you want to look online, look up ionized water that's alkaline, and you'll see that it's great for emulsifying oils, degreasing, and the oil, when you mix the water and the oil together, you know, they say oil and water don't mix. Well, if it's highly alkaline, freshly ionized water, it will, and it never disperses once again. So, I mean, never separates once again after it's dispersed, the oil. So I'll have to catch his response here on the time delay.
All right, Chris, I appreciate that. So, Craig, let's go to the next question, if you don't mind.
Okay.
All right. So who am I speaking with here? You told the phone answerer that you're the science guy from Third Rock Under the Sun. Who am I speaking with?
Yes, that's who I claim to be. I want to make a point about this dispersant. It disperses by combining itself with the oil and creating a more toxic chemical. And to say that there's not any studies on this is just untrue. There's no American studies on it. The European Union and the European nations have done extensive study on corrective use of it. They knew of its toxicity, and they knew that what happens is when you use it, it combines with the oil to create a much more toxic substance that's heavier and keeps from floating to the top. That's why you have the plume along the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico.
All right, let's see what Craig has to say about that. Thanks for the call, Clay. Craig, is the combination more toxic?
Yes, I think that was the concern. That's why they were looking at that. And as for it, it's true that European countries have done studies on the toxicity of it, and it, as I understand it, it's not allowed there. But this was the first federal study, the first study ever done by the U.S. government that said that looked at the human health concerns as a result of using these dispersants. So that's why it's sort of this sort of, you know, blockbuster thing that the federal government that said go ahead and use the dispersants is now saying, you know, oops, it was bad for people. So
our guest is Tampa Bay Times staff writer Craig Pittman. We're talking about a study that he wrote about that was from the National Institutes of Health that found health effects of the dispersant that BP used in the Deepwater Horizon disaster. And the number to call is 813-239-9663. If you'd like, you can email us at dj@wmnf.org, or you can text 813-433-0885. And when I spoke with David Hollander, he's a professor of chemical oceanography at the University of South Florida College of Marine Science, one of the professors that's been studying the spill since it happened. And you mentioned earlier that when the dispersants combined with the oil, the term that he used is a flocculant blizzard. The dispersants in the oil would get together with these sediments and things from the Mississippi River, and then it all rained down, or a lot of it rained down to the floor of the Gulf of Mexico. So I guess I should ask, where did all the oil end up? We're talking about millions of barrels of oil. Where is it now? Some of it was cleaned up, but where did it end up?
Some of it was eaten by microbes, bacteria, that kind of thing. And so the oil companies and the government were very happy about that. Some of it's still out there. The term that I've heard David Hollander use is a dirty blizzard. It became this sort of dirty blizzard of material that fell to the bottom of the Gulf, and its immediate impact was to kill off these very microscopic animals that live there that are sort of at the base of the food chain. They're able to take core samples, basically to dig down and take a section of the Gulf floor and be able to show that, you know, that this happened and that there was this massive die-off during this time period that correlates with the falling of this sort of dirty blizzard of dispersant and oil particles and so forth that sort of smothered them and prevented them from continuing to live. And, of course, if you knock out the base of the food chain, then that's going to have repercussions all the way up.
The study that we're talking about here was the first peer-reviewed study, but there have been anecdotal things that have come out ever since the dispersants were first used. Anita writes in that she says, check out the Second Wind Project with Tricia Springsteed. And she says that not just workers, but coastal citizens were affected by the dispersants used, and that eyewitnesses saw dispersants being sprayed everywhere, even over land. Our own military did it, and these operations were staged out of military bases. The truth needs to be told. There's also a lawsuit now from the Downs Law Group. So that's information coming in from Anita.
Right.
Have you've talked to people who have been affected perhaps by the...
Yeah, I talked to some divers who were working in Louisiana waters collecting samples, as well as taking some reporters and other people out to actually see the disaster. One of them took Jeff Corwin out for CBS News. And just... by diving into it, they started experiencing health impacts from it right away. The difference between that and this particular study is, as you mentioned, that they're anecdotal stories of, hey, I came in contact with this stuff and I got sick, versus this very rigorous epidemiological study where they looked strictly at people that they knew for sure had come in contact with the oil and dispersants as part of the cleanup crew, and they had been able to eliminate other health symptoms they might be experiencing through, you know, lifestyle, through smoking, et cetera, and to say that, okay, it's not that, it's this, it's specifically this. So, that's the kind of thing that they were looking at to try to make sure that they weren't, being wrong, picking the wrong culprit in the case of these symptoms, that they were actually doing the right thing and saying, yes, pointing the finger at the right culprit and saying, yes, that's the problem, not these other things. So they had to separate out not just, you know, those sort of lifestyle choice things of you know, obesity, cigarette smoking, that kind of stuff, but also separate out the impact that the oil itself would have on them versus the impact of this person.
Could they do that? Could they say that these people were sick just because of the dispersants and not the oil?
Right. They were saying that these were people who specifically came in contact with oil mixed with dispersants, and that these are symptoms that would not necessarily have been caused by the oil, but could have been caused, or rather were caused by the dispersant. And so they were able to point the finger at the dispersant and say, you know, this is it. This is the culprit.
Our guest is Tampa Bay Times staff writer Craig Pittman. You're listening to 88.5 FM WMNF Tampa. My name is Sean Canaan. I'm the host of Midpoint Monday, and we're taking your calls about dispersants and the BP oil disaster. 813-239-9663. BP's use of the dispersant during the Deepwater Horizon disaster has affected the health of cleanup workers. This is the first study that's been published, a scientific study, peer-reviewed study that's been published to demonstrate that the health of cleanup workers has been affected. DJ at WMNF.org if you'd like to email us, or text 813-433-0885. A minute ago, Craig, you mentioned that you talked to divers who had experienced some exposure to the dispersants and had health effects, but how are these other 800 people exposed that besides divers who were down there cleaning up, what other jobs were there and how were they exposed to the dispersant?
BP hired a number of people who needed work, frankly, to help out with the cleanup. And some of those folks, of course, were, you know, we saw them up on the beaches in hazmat suits collecting the oil. Those are not the folks that were part of this part of the study. They're part of the overall, you know, 33,000 people study, but there's a much smaller group that was actually out on the water. They were divers. They were commercial fishermen who were out there trying to spot the oil mats as they were floating around, collect them in. Anyone who was on the water and would have been out there at a time when the spraying was going on, those are the ones who were part of this sort of subset that they figure is about 600 people out of that larger group.
What has been the response of the manufacturer of Corexit? That's the brand name of the dispersant, Corexit, and it's made by Nalco and BP. Have you reached out to them to get a response?
I did. I called their corporate headquarters on Friday and got no response from either company. Not surprising in the case of Nalco, because they have been very, very quiet about their role in all this and have not responded to any of my previous efforts to reach them. I was surprised about BP, because usually BP is very quick to respond to questions from the press. They're very, they usually offer a very strong defense of the steps that they took in dealing with this sort of unprecedented oil spill disaster. Nobody had ever dealt with anything like this before. And they, in previous times, and when I did the story on the divers back in 2013, BP's defense was, we did what the EPA told us we could do. This was the option that we were allowed to do by the government, and we did constant monitoring, and we were not aware of any health impacts. Now, why they couldn't issue that same statement this time around, I don't know, but they chose not to respond. So I can't tell you why.
We're speaking with Craig Pittman, a Tampa Bay Times staff writer, writing about the dispersant study. And you mentioned a minute ago, and I should give out the number, 813-239-9663, if you have a question for Craig. You mentioned that people needed work. So bring us back in time. This was 7 years ago. A lot of us remember it very well, but maybe people have just moved into the area, or they just read about it in newspapers or watched it on TV or heard about it on the radio. Why was there such desperate need for work? And what just set the scene for us. What was going on during that those 3 or so months of this oil gusher?
Well, it started in April of 2010. There was an explosion aboard this deepwater drilling rig called the Deepwater Horizon. The 11 people were killed in the explosion. The rest were able to be evacuated off the rig. It sank into the water, and initially there was no sign of any leak. But a couple of days after it sank, then the wellhead down 5,000 feet below the surface began spewing out oil. And it continued spewing oil all through the early part of the summer. They weren't able to get a handle on it until, I think, mid-July to finally shut it off. So that oil came up to the surface and spread over the coastline in Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, and eventually by June it made it all the way to the Florida beaches. So there were eight counties in Florida that wound up with oil tainting their beaches at a time when, in early summer, when they are counting on a lot of people coming to the beaches and enjoying them and spending money. So it had a major economic impact in terms of hurting tourism, charter boats, beach wedding photographers. I mean, it's incredible the number of people whose lives were touched by this thing, sort of showing you that the environment is the economy, particularly in Florida. Commercial fishermen were particularly hurt by this because while the oil was spewing out, the National Marine Fisheries Service, which has its southeastern office here in St. Petersburg, they were issuing orders to close off parts of the Gulf to commercial fishing during this time, because obviously you wouldn't want to be reeling in fish, shrimp, et cetera, from the area where the oil was. That would taint it. There were all kinds of questions about the safety of seafood being pulled from anywhere in the Gulf during that time. A lot of restaurants all across the country stopped serving Gulf seafood during this time because they were worried about the quality of all the seafood, and that really hurt the commercial fishing industry. And so a lot of those folks turned to employment from BP in order to have some income coming in. But, of course, then some of them then resulted in having some health impacts from it as a result. And so, that it turned out to be sort of a mixed blessing for them in terms of having something to do, but then it could have led to larger problems for them as well. So that's why BP has been giving out millions of dollars trying to make things right. And it's kind of ironic, the money that they gave to some of the states has been used in ways you wouldn't necessarily associate with trying to clean up after an oil spill. For instance, Alabama was planning to rebuild a hotel and convention center on their beachfront that had been destroyed by a hurricane. That was what they were going to use their oil spill money for, and not for anything to necessarily improve the environment. So there's been some disputes about how the money is being spent and that kind of thing, too.
And part of the money, a different pool perhaps, but is going to scientific research, and a lot of that is coming to USF. They just got a renewal of another $5 million to monitor the spill. What kinds of research is going on at USF, if that's not too far afield from our topic today?
If there is an upside to this, it's that suddenly there's a tremendous amount of money available for studying the Gulf of Mexico, which we really don't know much about. And I've heard scientists at USF St. Pete make this point that, if only the oil companies had been required to do baseline scientific studies before they were allowed to drill, we would know more about what was harmed by the oil spills out there than we do now. But because of the BP oil spill, because BP was required to put up all of this money to try and fund an investigation into what damage they did, as a result, we now know more about the Gulf than we ever did before. A lot of that money did go to USF St. Pete. They have their own research vessel, which a lot of educational institutions do not, so they were able to sail around the Gulf taking samples, doing all kinds of very important work. One of the aspects that they've been reviewing lately has been they're looking at parallels between the BP oil spill of 2010 and an oil spill that occurred off the coast of Mexico in 1979, the Ixtoc oil spill, which at the time was the biggest of its kind, and followed sort of the same pattern where there was this spill. It took a long time to get it shut off. In the meantime, oil floated miles and miles and miles away and wound up contaminating shorelines quite a distance away. And one of the things they discovered when they went looking for samples down in Mexico, they actually found that some of that oil is still present on the shoreline where it washed up back in 1979. It hasn't gone away. So you can sort of expect, you know, yes, you know, 2010 seems like a long time ago, but there's probably oil still hidden along the coastlines where it washed ashore all that time ago, just based on what happened with the 1979 spill.
We're speaking with Craig Pittman, a Tampa Bay Times staff writer, and the number to call in is 813-239-9663. You can email dj at wmnf.org or text 813-433-0885. Amy's on the line. We're going to go to her in just a minute. I'm going to first ask a question that came in from email. I think it's a kind of a tongue-in-cheek question. David says, thanks for bringing Craig on today. This is an important topic that should be getting more publicity. And David says he's wondering, how much is BP spending to disperse publicity on this topic? It should be getting more attention on CNN, MSNBC, etc., but maybe BP and Nalco's spin machine is working hard on the response. Have you seen, Craig, have you seen this study publicized much outside of the Tampa Bay Times?
There were stories in the Mobile Press Register and the New Orleans Times Picayune, but beyond that, I have not seen coverage of this. I think because people, how can I put this? Our modern society, we tend to focus on what's right in front of us and not pay close attention to the past. And so there's so much going on right now with the whole NFL protest and the North Korea shooting off missiles and Hurricane Maria devastating Puerto Rico and Hurricane Irma, you know, with its devastation here in Florida, that it's hard to get people's attention to something, a scientific study about something that happened 7 years ago. You know, at the time the oil spill happened, some people, you know, Rush Limbaugh among them, Time Magazine too, said, oh, it wasn't too bad. People thought it was going to be this horrible thing, and look, everything's okay. Well, you know, you got to let time pass in order to see the true impact of this kind of stuff. And now we're starting to see exactly what happened back then and maybe take lessons for the future from it. Maybe not.
Craig, we're getting an email from someone named Les, and Les says he used to think that dispersant was a detergent like Dawn, but then he reviewed, or she, I'm sorry, I don't know the gender, the Nalco MSDS. Boy, was I wrong, and he attaches the Corexit MSDS statement. As a chemist, I should do my homework first, is what Les says from email. So what can you tell us about what is in Corexit?
Not much. I'm not a chemist, but I can tell you this, that and this I got from the folks from the National Institutes of Health, because I said I thought it was, you know, just basically a type of soap, and they said, no, there's some of that in it, but also it contains chemicals used for cleaning, and so those are the sort of toxic elements that harm people, or those segments of it. My understanding is that Nalco is keeping quiet about what some of those ingredients are, at least publicly, because of course they're, you know, that's a trade secret for them. But National Institutes of Health has it, and so they are able to tell, you know, more specifically, here's what happened, here's why, here's what caused it, that kind of thing.
Are there hydrocarbons? So are you like fighting oil with more oil?
I don't know.
Okay. All right. Well, let's go back to the phones. Here's Amy in St. Petersburg. Hi, Amy.
Hi. Hi, Craig. Thanks for the work you do. It's amazing. I think it's most important work going on in our area.
Thank you.
what do you think that individual citizens, what's the single most important thing that the average person can do to help advocate that our water is clean, whether it's fracking or whether it's the BP oil spill or all these environmental threats? Is protesting really that effective?
Gosh, that's a hard one. I don't know what to tell you. Some people go out and protest. Some people file lawsuits. Each has its own impact in its own way. I mean, clearly, the Keystone Pipeline protest captured everybody's attention across the country. Sable Trail Pipeline protest did the same, and yet the pipelines were built anyway. So, in some cases, it's just hard to say which one is more effective and which one is not. I guess the big thing people need to do is pay attention. Watch the news, pay attention to the news, read the newspaper, and see what's going on. And if you see something that you think is going to affect you and affect your drinking water, then take action about it. A lot of that stuff happens on the local level to start with. City council, county commission, zoning hearings, those things, they seem boring, but they're ultimately fairly important, and that's where things can be nipped in the bud if they need to be. So that would be my advice to everybody is just, part of the thing about being a democracy is that you're supposed to pay attention to what your elected representatives are doing and let them know if they're not doing it right. And so that would be my advice is just pay attention.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks so much. Thanks so much for the call, Amy. I appreciate that. We'll go back to the phones in just a minute. Gary's holding on the line, but I'm going to ask a question from email first. So Terry writes, I used to live on Indian Rocks Beach, but I haven't been swimming since the spill because of it. Is it safe to swim yet, Craig?
Oh, I don't know. I would check with the Department of Health, check their website and see what they say and go from there. I know that a lot of communities all across the state have experienced serious problems with sewage spills as a result of the hurricane, as a result of the flooding, and that may be continuing to be a problem. And on the beaches, I don't know. So that would be my first step, would be to check with the Department of Health, check with the county, and see if it's safe to swim out there.
The county.
I know that in some parts of the state, there have been advisories issued for the beaches saying, there's the high fecal coliform count out there, and you really don't want to mess with that because you don't want to deal with all the sickness that springs from them.
And they sample every once in a while, like every few days. So if it's good one day, it might be bad a few days later, and it might be good again a few days after that. So keep monitoring it.
Just keep monitoring it. Yeah, definitely.
Our guest is Craig Pittman with the Tampa Bay Times, and we're talking about a new study from the National Institutes of Health about dispersants and their effects on human health. Craig, do you have a few more minutes? I didn't really. I don't want to make this open-ended if you can't make it.
I do need to go. I'm sorry.
Okay. No, I really appreciate your time today. So thanks so much for joining us, Craig Pittman.
Okay. My pleasure. Take care.
Thanks so much. Craig Pittman is a staff writer with the Tampa Bay Times. And we will go back to the phone lines. Thanks for joining us on the show. Gary and Dunedin, sorry we don't have our guests with us, but if you want to make a statement or a question that I might be able to help you with, what's on your mind?
Well, hopefully he's listening somehow. But I got to tell you, the focus on the BP spill, it's good to focus on it. BP is a corporate criminal. But I'm 62 years old and was born and raised in Pinellas and have been a nature lover, photographer, swimmer, kayaker since I was a baby, really. And regardless of the BP spill, the Gulf of Mexico is dying. It's dying up north of us because of that massive dead zone that's increasing every year at the mouth of the Mississippi. I think it's now the size of three states. But because of population growth, development, boats, jet skis, fishing, crab trapping, etc., the Gulf is basically on life support. There's a reason why my hometown of Clearwater was called Clearwater, because the water in the Gulf was like spring water when I was young, and there was about 5,000% more species diversity of fish, shorebirds, waders, and shells nowadays you're lucky if you see a pelican. The Gulf is being killed, and it's because of population growth, densification. The sewage plants can't handle the amount of defecators that are here now, but yet the politicians and a lot of people want more and more growth, more and more densification, more and more people to move here, and more tourism. And I'm in mourning for the Gulf. When I swim now, as compared to 20, 30 years ago, I always get skin rashes and eye irritations. And because of the tourism industry and the media covering up for the tourism industry, they don't accurately report the health hazards of the Gulf pollution. And when they do report it, they try and blame it on red tide and stuff like that. It's an ongoing ecocide, which is the murder of the environment. And Craig is the only real environmental journalist left in the state at a major newspaper.
All right, Gary, thanks for your thoughts. And if you'd like to join the conversation, the number to call is 813-239-9663. We'll get you on the air right away. Or if you'd like to email us at dj@wmnf.org or text 813-433-0885. It's 12:42 in the afternoon. My name is Sean Canan. I'm the host of Midpoint Monday on 88.5 FM and on wmnf.org. And we are talking about the BP's use of dispersant during the Deepwater Horizon disaster. It was controversial at the time, and some people, anecdotally, we heard about health effects. And now, 7 years later, the National Institutes of Health has come out with a study that says that, yes, the health of cleanup workers was affected by by dispersants. And so if that's something you'd like to talk about, give us a call, 813-239-9663 or dj@wmnf.org. Let's go back to the phones. We have George in Lakeland. Hi, George.
Yes, I can't believe that Craig Pittman missed a great opportunity. The caller asked him, what can she do? And he just completely ignored the fact that we're not connecting the dots. So I will tell that woman what she can do. Drive an electric car, number one. Put in solar panels. Consume less fossil fuels. Consume less gasoline. Consume less oil. That's what we all need to start doing now. Not 20 years from now. When 20 years from now, it's going to be far even worse. And it's going to affect our economy even worse. So we're going to end up paying more because we're refusing to take action today. I mean, it's just crystal clear. We got to connect the dots, folks. We are polluting the hell out of our planet. That's all I got.
All right, George, thanks for connecting the dots for us. 813-239-9663 is the number to call. Let's head to Jackie in Palm Harbor. Hi, Jackie.
Hi, Sean. I just wanted to call and say I totally agree with Gary. I've lived here since 1964. And I learned how to swim in the Gulf of Mexico. And, you know, boating was so much easier. And, you know, recreation was, you didn't get a warning that you can't go underwater because of human waste. And it almost makes me want to move away from the state because, like he said, the irritants and whatnot, it's like you go to the beach and you look at the Gulf of Mexico. And you don't even know if you'll be okay if you go swimming. And when you've lived here all your life or for, you know, 3 and 4 generations, you do. You mourn the Gulf of Mexico. And it just seems like, you know, these dead zones and whatnot, it's like how much waste can get into the water before they tell us we can't swim anymore. I mean, it seems like it's just been going on for years and we don't know the truth, and that's the scariest part. And I thank you for this forum.
Jackie, thanks so much for calling in. If you'd like to call in and tell us your remembrances of how the Gulf of Mexico used to be or your ideas about how we could make it great again, I guess, make the Gulf great again, to steal a phrase, 813-239-9663, dj@wmnf.org, 813-433-0885 is the number to text. It's 12:45 in the afternoon, and you're listening to 88.5 FM, WMNF Tampa, and welcome, Elizabeth, in Riverview.
Oh, yes, sir. Sean, let me add to the growing list of what people say must be done to save the whole cotton-picking state of Florida, and that's all there is to it, the waters included. Let me add my voice to please do something about using the fuel that we do. Find alternative fuels. We don't need to use all that gasoline. The politicians, if they would merely put back, impact fees on development, that possibly would slow it. I don't say that it would do away with it entirely, but make them pay the impact fees and put in the infrastructure that is needed for this massive condo or whatever they want to put up before they do it, and then we get taxed later on to pay for what they should have done to begin with. These kind of things must be paid attention to here in Florida, or there won't be anything left of it that's worth visiting or living in. All right, sir. That's about all I have to say. Thank you.
All right, Elizabeth, thanks so much for your call. 813. Bye. Thank you. Bye. 813-239-9663. If you'd like to join the conversation, we're going to go to Richard in Tampa in just a minute. But right now, I'm going to give out the number for you to text in if you'd like. 813-433-0885. You can email DJ at WMNF.org. We do have a text that I'm going to read right now, and it says, this text from 941 area code asks, how about all the perfect green lawns? I think that person is tying in the use of fertilizer to the decline of the Gulf of Mexico and some other bodies of water. 813-239-9663. If you'd like to call in, Richard in Tampa, you're on the air.
Yes, I think the only way we're going to have to be able to change things to make the Gulf better and make our state better is to give the voice of the people and give the power back to the voice of the people. I mean, the corporations and our government, our, you know, national government, which is, you know, in business with a lot of different corporations around our country, you know, they don't seek to look out for the best interests of the people and where the people live. I mean, we have to live in the state. We have to swim in these waters. I mean, everything that's been said before I even came on to give my comments, they're talking about the birds, the quality of the water. I mean, I was born in Fort Lauderdale, Florida in 1963, and I recently revisited Fort Lauderdale, Florida. You know, you don't see birds there. All you see is iguanas in the trees, and lizards and snakes have taken over everywhere. I mean, if that's what it's coming to, then, you know, we need the power of the people to take back what is ours and protect what is ours for the generations to come. But slowly but surely, you know, not as nice as it was the way it used to be. Thank you very much.
All right, Richard, thank you for weighing in. 813-239-9663. If you'd like to join this conversation, if you'd like to talk about the Gulf of Mexico, about dispersants, about the oil spill, the oil disaster in 2010, 813-239-9663. We'll go to Brad and Brandon in just a minute. But right now, I want to read a text from the 813 area code. Ron in West Tampa says, our Gulf is being slowly killed by the oil spills and so many other sources of pollution. And I remember a Gulf of Mexico that was once much clearer and cleaner. Growth is killing Florida and our precious waterways, says Ron in Tampa. So there's a theme that a lot of people are saying that growth and fossil fuels are hurting the way the Florida that they remember. So that's something that people are weighing in about. What do you think? And I should also say that 2 hours ago, on the sustainability show with John Butts, there was a great, discussion about the advances in solar power technology. So if you didn't get a chance to hear that, go ahead and listen to that on WMNF.org. There's talking about new batteries and new types of solar power and inverters and all sorts of things that if you're interested in solar power, that's a really good resource. I'm going to go back and listen to it, as soon as I can, because I didn't get to completely listen when I was preparing for this show. But let's hear from Brad in Brandon. What's on your mind, Brad?
I am a much younger guy, 27, and I have much older parents who moved here in the early 70s, and he showed me pictures of our bay off of Bayshore Boulevard before they started dumping sewage, and I was shocked. Like, it used to be crystal clear. It was blue.
You know, and here's the thing is that the Tampa Bay is actually, it got worse, and then it's getting better right now. Right now, the trend is improving. So, and it's still, I'm sure, still not back to where it was in the time when you're talking about. But I guess, you know, if there's a good side, a happy side to this story, is that Tampa Bay is getting cleaner. There's more seagrasses and so forth than it was maybe 20 or 25 years ago. But you're saying even before that, it was crystal clear?
Yes, yeah, it was like I have never seen pictures of like that of the bay. I thought it was a different place completely, which was shocking to me. Because I'm just like any other Floridian. I'm a huge avid fisherman. I love our nature, and it's one of the big draws to the state. And if we keep dumping on it, it's just going to turn into a horrible for all of us. It's going to affect every part of our state and every part of our infrastructure.
All right, Brad, thanks so much for calling in. 813-239-9663 if you'd like to join this conversation. I have Diane in Bradenton on the air. Before you start, Diane, I just want to remind people that earlier in the show, we had Tampa Bay Times staff writer Craig Pittman. So if you missed that, you can go back and listen to it on the archives at WMNF.org. And we were talking about a new study that shows that dispersants affected the human health of cleanup workers after the BP oil disaster in 2010. All right, Diane, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Responding to one of your earlier callers, a couple of calls back, about 40 years ago when environmental education was just coming into the schools, I was taking a train the trainers course, and there was a lobbyist there for the rose growers, and he was explaining to us how lobbying works. And I naively said, who represents the people? Because he represented the businesses, the politicians represent the people who give them money. And he said, no one represents the people. Simple as that.
Some honesty there, huh?
Mm-hmm. That's all I have. Thanks.
All right, great. Thank you, Diane. I appreciate you calling in. 813-239-9663 if you'd like to get in on the last 7 or 8 minutes of the show. You're listening to 88.5 FM WMNF Tampa. I'm Sean Canaan. I'm the host of Midpoint Monday, and I'm going to read some a little bit from an interview I did with a researcher at University of South Florida, a professor of chemical oceanography at USF College of Marine Science in St. Petersburg, David Hollander. I asked him about the safety of seafood after the use of dispersants and the oil disaster in the Gulf of Mexico. And he said the safety of seafood is probably better than it ever has been in the context that more eyes are watching. The testing is rigorous. There are parts of the fish that still continually show contamination, whether that's chronic or relaxation from an acute event, that's still to be debated. It's principally in the liver and the gallbladder, and those you shouldn't be eating anyway. If you do the testing in the muscle, it looks perfectly good. So this is 6 years after the oil disaster. He said that the seafood was fine in the Gulf of Mexico. And then I asked him about the deformities that we've seen anecdotes of, photos of from the Gulf of Mexico organisms. And I asked him if he thought that they might be related to the BP spill. And he says, well, I think that's our largest fear, is that there's actually genetic alteration of the next and following generations. And this is why you can't rush to judgment to say that the Gulf has been restored itself and resilient. Things happen and they have to work their way through the ecosystem, which may be generational. So that's a tiny bit of an interview I did about a year ago with a professor of college at the College of Marine Science at USF who's been studying the BP oil disaster for those 6 years, and he continues to study it. That's on our website, WMNF.org. If you want to just search for BP or something like that, you'll find all of our coverage of BP over the years. Let's go to Elizabeth in Tampa. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi.
Oh, she's gone. All right, call back if you'd like, or anyone else can call back. Here's the number to call, 813-239-9663. If you'd like to email dj@wmnf.org or text 813-433-0885. Let me read some headlines from today. North Korea's top diplomat says President Donald Trump's tweet that leader Kim Jong-un won't be around much longer was a declaration of war against his country by the United States. The foreign minister told reporters today that what he called Trump's declaration of war, gives North Korea every right under the UN Charter to take countermeasures, including the right to shoot down the United States strategic bombers even though they're not yet inside the airspace border of our country. So there's a heating of war of words between North Korea and the Trump administration. Also, in the last few hours, Anthony Weiner must report to prison by November 6th to begin serving his 21-month sentence for sexting with a 15-year-old girl. As his sentence was announced today, the former Democratic congressmember from New York dropped his head into his hand and wept. Weiner's sexting habit destroyed his career in Congress, his campaign for mayor, and his marriage to a former aide to Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. So those are some of the news topics that hopefully we'll hear updates about at the top of the hour on NPR News. You're listening to 88.5 FM WMNF Tampa. My name is Sean Canaan. I'm the host of Midpoint Monday. Tomorrow at noon on Midpoint Tuesday will be your hero, Mark Bureau. And coming up after this show, stay tuned because Craig Kopp will join us in executive session. And we're waiting to hear your phone calls. I should say this is after Hurricane Irma, that the Florida Keys officials have announced today that the reopening date for visitors to return to the Florida Keys is Sunday, October 1st. So right now it's only a few residents who are going down there and cleaning out their residences. There are no visitors allowed there. So you can think about how much of an effect that has on the Keys economy, which is based largely on tourism. Tourism won't resume until October 1st. Senator Rand Paul says, his spokesperson says the Kentucky Republican remains opposed to the GOP bill that repeals the Obama health care law. Paul's opposition would almost certainly doom the measure. So they only need three Republicans. If three Republicans vote no on that measure this week, it will fail. Also, voicemails left on Florida Governor Rick Scott's cell phone by employees of the Hollywood nursing home where 11 people died after Hurricane Irma. Those emails have been deleted, according to the governor's office. Scott gave out his number to nursing homes and assisted living facilities ahead of the hurricane so administrators could report concerns. That's according to a timeline released by Scott's office. And in the days following Irma, the staff at the Rehabilitation Center at Hollywood Hills called four times, but the messages they left the governor were not kept. And this was first reported by CBS4's Jim DeFeed. And I'm reading here from the Miami Herald, I should say. The voicemails were not retained because the information from each voicemail was collected by the governor's staff and given to the proper agency for handling. Every call was returned. That's in a statement from a spokesperson for Governor Rick Scott. And I should also say one last bit of news here. A worker trimming trees in Siesta Key was electrocuted by a power line that was hanging low because of Hurricane Irma's winds. The accident happened yesterday afternoon, and the worker was pronounced dead at the scene. Sarasota County Emergency Services said the victim was working in a bucket and could not be reached until Florida Power and Light could come on and turn off the grid. All right, well, those are some of the news stories that we're following this hour. And I want to thank everyone who called and emailed and texted today to Midpoint. We got 17 people on the air, and I appreciate everyone for calling in. And in 2 weeks, we're going to be asking Midpoint Monday supporters to financially support the show. So if you want to make a donation ahead of time, that would really help us out. And the way you can do that is go to WMNF.org and make a tip jar donation there, or donate it to Midpoint Monday on the tip jar. So thanks so much for everyone who called, emailed, and texted today. If you'd still like to leave a voicemail with your thoughts, I'll play them next week. Give me a call at 813-238-8001, extension 114, and I'll play your message next show. You can also join the conversation online at WMNF.org/news. Or on Facebook or Twitter at WMNF News. I want to thank our engineer Alvaro Montealegre and our phone answerer Frank Knox today. And I should also say that if you'd like to find out more about Puerto Rico and how Puerto Rico is faring after Hurricane Maria, there's a story up on the front of our website, WMNF.org, written by a resident of Puerto Rico about how you can help and what kind of needs there are in Puerto Rico right now. Well, thanks so much for joining us. Coming up after NPR headlines, we'll hear executive session. This is WMNF Tampa, St. Petersburg, Sarasota. Thanks so much for listening.